Hi, welcome to The Left Brain Artist. I'm Suzanne Redmond. A lot of people have wondered how I find the artists that I interview on this podcast. Well, about half of them are local, and I've met them working at and attending art events here in Palm Beach County, Florida. Others I've recently started following on Instagram because I love their artwork. And others are artists that I've taken a class with or I've met at classes. In 2007 to 2010, I attended a series of art classes in Portland, Oregon, called Art and Soul. That art retreat is about a week long, and you choose one full-day art class to take per day. I usually took 6 classes per week, with 6 different instructors, and I met many other artists in my classes or at the retreat. That was pre-Facebook and Instagram, but back then we kept in touch through email or Yahoo groups. I've since followed the careers of many of these artists through Facebook and Instagram and through magazines like Somerset Studio and Cloth Paper Scissors. Today's artist is Michael Demang. He lives in Vancouver, British Columbia with his wife, artist Andrea Mattis. They travel all over the world teaching art classes. I met him in 2008 when I took a class with him in Portland. After I interviewed him, I went back through the things I saved from Art and Soul and saw that the class I took from him was called Shadowbox Tarot Cards. If you can, take a minute and look at my show notes on my website for this episode and see the kind of art that Michael makes. I'd like you to have a picture in your head of his art when you hear this interview. He makes 3D sculptures from found objects, and each piece tells a story. Often that story has its roots in mythology. So take a look at the wild and amazing artwork that he makes, and then give this episode a listen. This is Michael Demang. Michael, it's nice to see you. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, good to see you too, Suzanne. Thanks for inviting me. Should be fun.
I think this time of year, right before the holidays, you're finally back in your hometown or wherever you live. Where are you calling from today?
Vancouver, BC.
Okay.
I always do my annual Day of the Dead retreat down in Oaxaca, Mexico. So I just got back from that. Yeah, that usually is kind of the sort of the finale for the year, my last event for the year usually. So now I can settle down and make little Krampus toys and things like that. So
right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I want to go backwards a little bit and see if you can tell me. I'm familiar with your artwork because I took one of your classes at Portland Art and Soul quite a few years ago. But what you call your artwork is assemblage, but it contains lots of different components. Can you tell me, when did you start making that type of art? Or did you start making, were you doing other things when you were younger? How did it become to what it is today?
Well, I like to use the word assemblage.
You
might have remembered that from way back when.
Yes.
Assemblage is just a fancier way, to make people impressed. So basically the first time I started doing it was, it would have been easily over 20 years ago.
Okay.
And I was mostly painting/collage back then. And it was actually a trip to Mexico that sort of got me into assemblage. And it was, I had been down there and I started seeing, the one thing about Mexico is things die hard. So, if you have a sewing machine, they're going to use it to the nth degree before they give it up. It's like the disposable society that we have up here, right? So things are just used and used and used. And that's true even after they're not usable. So, I went down there and I started seeing, things, shrines and things made out of whatever. And then that, of course, gave me the idea. And I immediately came home. And I remember the first thing I made, the first assemblage that I made, was actually a shrine, because as I said, I just came from Mexico seeing a lot of weird sardine can shrines and whatever. And I made a shovel shrine. So, the shovel has sort of a shape that's sort of shrine-like. And so I actually turned that into a shrine. And so that 20 plus years ago, 25 years ago, maybe, that was the first piece of assemblage art that I did.
Oh, so. Wow. Do you still have that one?
No, that's sold many, many years ago, but it's
well,
still
great.
Yes, it's still it is still hanging in someone's home. So that's as far as I know.
Yes.
Hopefully it didn't go into a garage sale. So
Yeah. Okay, so 20 years ago, what were you doing for a living then?
Well, at that time, let's see, I would have been I had always been doing art after art school, but what I had been doing was working about 20 hours a week bartending and then, you know, doing art. So, you know, the typical, you know, starving artist routine, you know, cram in 20 to 30 hours of work, you know, and doing double shifts and then having about, you know, 5 days of studio time. And that's kind of what I was doing.
Was this in Montana?
Yeah, this was in Missoula, Montana.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you spent many years there. Is that where you grew up?
No, that I grew up mostly in California, though kind of here and there, but mostly in California. And I went to, I finished my art degree at the University of Montana in Missoula. And then Missoula is kind of like the cultural mecca of the state. And so it was, it's a really good place to be a starving artist, not necessarily a good place to be a working artist, but a really great place to be a starving artist. So, you know, I hang out there and starved for a while and had a good time. So.
Well, you know, as places to be starving, I'm sure it was a pretty nice place to be doing that.
It's a fun place.
Right. So. Is it still very, very art centric today?
Yeah, very much so. It's you know, obviously it's a university town. So that always, you know, it's kind of like a Boulder, Colorado type of town. Right.
Yep.
So they, you know, they've got plenty of breweries and plenty of, you know, and plenty of theaters and plenty of, you know, concert places. The one thing I do miss, because I moved away from there, 7 years ago, I guess. The one thing I do miss about that area is that because it's in the middle of, you know, Montana and arts are, you know, you really have to struggle to get art,
right,
you know, per se. You know, you don't have a major metropolis nearby that has, oh, here's an opera and here's whatever. The arts community is really tight knit because it really has to be tight knit. So, to survive. And so it's, you know, very, very, one of the strongest arts community I've ever been around, you know, so it's pretty cool.
Oh, okay. That's a great way to describe it then. Okay. I understand what you're saying. So were there galleries there where you were selling your work?
Yeah, off and on. The galleries were, you know, the galleries there were always, you know, you'd sell a piece here and sell a piece there. You know, typically I would sell outside of the area more than I would there, you know, because it is a, you know, it is not a booming economy necessarily. It certainly wasn't when I was there. It's better now, but it still was, you know, it was a struggling, you know, middle of Montana sort of town that kind of, you know,
right,
buying art wasn't necessarily the high priority. So.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So where did you go from the beginnings of making that shovel shrine? What other types of things did you do? And when did you realize, okay, this is it. I'm going to stick with this and I'm going to do a lot of this.
Well, you know, it was almost immediate because it was, it sort of happens to this day. In fact, I work on stuff and then I get just bored, you know, and it's sort of like, oh, what am I going to do? Am I going to make the same thing I just made over and over and over again? And so suddenly I had this fresh, you know, vision, and it sort of just pushed me in a direction and really haven't turned much from it. Now, granted, I still incorporate, you know, a lot of the painting that I do. Most, you know, a lot of my pieces really involve in some degree more painting than actually, you know, sculpture. I mean, if you really look at it in time wise, right?
Right.
But you know, it's one of those things of just, you know, taking what I had and then just morphing it in a different direction. And, you know, as I said, it still happens today. You sort of like, okay, I'm bored. I'm, you know, am I still an artist? I can't think of anything new. Oh, I've fooled everybody all these years, you know, that kind of
right,
stuff.
Right. That's crazy. But yeah, that's what the artists do.
Yeah.
True. So you started making these things but at some point you said, okay, well, I've got to somehow sell them or do something beyond the Montana or beyond the Missoula. Did you start by selling, like going to art festivals or, you know, outdoor events or going to galleries, or did you start by teaching?
Initially it was mostly galleries and such.
Okay.
And sometimes what I would do is kind of the early version of the pop-up galleries, you know, like it was a great artist that, that we were friends in Missoula, and we were called the Salt Mine Gallery, and any space that would open up, we'd, you know, sort of throw something in, you know, seasonal or whatever, maybe okay. Christmas or if a space pops up, we'd do a show. And so we were doing a bunch of that. And then I was showing in galleries here and there outside of Montana, because, you know, obviously that's where the money is. And then the teaching gig started, oh, probably about 12, 15 years ago, I guess.
Okay.
And so that, of course, opened up a whole new realm, because when I started, the first event that I taught at was Art Fest, which is no more, but that was in Port Townsend, Washington.
Right.
Tisha and Tracy. Yeah. Yep. And so, you know, that was a big event, and that opened a ton of doors, you know, in terms of, you know, both teaching and exhibiting and even selling at those venues was, you know, obviously a big issue. So.
Right. Right. How had you even heard of that one?
Well, I had actually been sort of, Tisha had sort of hounded me for a while, and I was sort of like, I don't really know what this is. You know, it's like, oh, I teach Mariah Band. It's like, okay, I don't know what that is, blah, blah, blah. And then eventually she set up a special event for me in Issaquah, just me one weekend, and said, just come and do this. And then if you like it, then, you know, maybe you'll consider teaching at Art Fest. And so I did that, and I'm like, wow, this is really cool. So I don't know why I was sort of avoiding this all these years, but, you know, it was, all of a sudden it's just like, wow, I jumped into a different sort of world. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think until you get into it, you don't realize that those people exist. And right. We're talking about pre-internet, or at least pre-Facebook and Instagram, you know, if you're saying 12 years ago. Yeah. So I know for me, the way I learned about it was subscribing to at first Rubber Stamp Madness magazine, and then later Somerset Studio. And that's how I heard about these things. Yeah. And for me, I went to Art and Soul, which was very similar to Art Fest. Yep. I never did go to Art Fest, but the reason I went to Art and Soul in Portland, and I live in Florida, is because my brother lives in Portland. So for me, I could go there. I could stay with him. I didn't rent a car. He'd drop me off at the hotel every morning, and I'd do the classes. Yeah.
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 It's a pretty cool idea, the concept.
It is.
You know,
yeah.
It's a very cool idea. So.
Yeah. So when you first started, was it multiple days? Was it always multiple days?
Yeah.
I'm not that familiar with Art Fest.
Yeah. So like originally back in the olden days, and it's funny how, you know, you get a little bit jaded in terms of how you want to teach, you know, but back in the olden days, you teach 1 day workshops, and that was all that was available. One day.
Mm-hmm.
And
they were project based. So the students would have something finished at the end.
We're going to do watercolor. We're going to, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to do something. Like, I think the first class I taught was, I think Pez Dispensing Totems, I think was the first workshop I taught there. And so you'd have to do that in 1 day. And it's funny because now I teach, you know, multiple day classes, especially like my vacation retreats, like, you know, the one I do in Mexico and the one coming up in New Orleans, you know, they're basically 4 days of classes. And so now it's like, that's become more my norm of like, you know, having a luxury as opposed to like, okay, now we got to do this. And
right.
Now we got to do this, you know, as opposed to like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, it's like, it's, you know, it's take your time and, you know, it's, get this refined. And so it's just,
yeah,
you know,
very
that
different.
Kind of, that was the thing. And now it, you know, I'm like struggle every time somebody says, oh, a 1 day class. I'm like, no, not a 1 day class. No.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, that's all I was familiar with. I think I did it like 4 or 5 years in a row, and I would take 5 1-day classes, and, you know, you had to really be done with that project because the next day you were doing something completely different, different instructor. You know, it might be, like you said, watercolor 1 day, and then you're doing, you know, jewelry making the next day as a student.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And maybe you'd go home and finish it, but I found that, you know, 8 times out of 10, that was never the case. People would be like, oh, yeah, I started that piece and I never finished it, you know, in the class. And, you know,
I guess I'm always been a fast worker. So I always finish mine. But the question was, did I ever make something similar to that ever again?
Sure.
So you learn
the
technique. Right. You've done this. Have you ever done soldering again, for example?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know. That's the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that, like, even some of the events that I teach at still, like Art Unraveled, which is in Arizona, that are like that, where I still do 1 day classes. It is funny because you see those people who will go to those events and they'll, you know, that one is like a 7 or 8 day event.
Yeah.
And they'll be doing day classes, and they also offer night classes, so that you'll have students who will literally take a, you know, 8 hour class and then do a 3 hour class and an 8 hour class. And they'll do that straight through.
Oh my gosh.
And usually by the end, you know, their brains explode and they're in tears. Oh my God. Ah, you know, and it's just a mental breakdown, you know, just
absolutely.
It's a lot.
Yeah. I did a full day class plus a 3 hour night class only once. And the 3 hour night class, the way the teacher taught it is she would say, okay, here's step one. I'll show you how to do step one. Now everybody do step one. And and I was really fast. And then you had to wait for everybody to finish step one before she would even tell you step two. And I just thought, I just can't take this. I'm too tired.
Right.
When we finally got to step 10 of, you know, 12, I said, okay, I know enough. I can finish this at home. I'm leaving. Yeah, it was a lot. But like you said, it's a class vacation. So it's a great opportunity for people to get away from their house and just really concentrate on it. And I always like just meeting so many people, especially at these big ones, because there's, what, 20 or 30 classes going on concurrently?
Correct. Yeah.
So at lunchtime, you're walking around, you're having lunch with all kinds of people.
Yeah, no, it's a great meeting. It's a great meeting place.
Yeah.
And I'd actually heard rumor that there's a, in Port Townsend where the Art Fest thing was, the Asian Trade were running. They're trying to get something new started there. In fact, I was just talking to them. The local peeps sort of miss, you know, all the convergent of 500, I think, students that would roll in there every year. And so there's a local group that they're starting small with just, you know, like isolated workshops, you know, at Fort Worden, which is where it was at. And I guess their goal is to try and do, you know, a big event. I don't know if it's going to be as big as Art Fest, but their goal is, because that was always such a wonderful place to go, because it was the setting, you know, right by the water and cute little Victorian town. And so
it's a very nice main street with lots of great shops. I went through there one time when I was doing a ferry to somewhere, I don't even remember.
But
I thought, this is a really great town. Okay, so let me go back to talking about your art.
Mm-hmm.
I've always felt that your art, you're always telling a story from the pieces that you're making, and so I want to ask you about that. How did it come about? You must have a love. I know you have a love of Day of the Dead. You must have a love of mythology, or even maybe cryptids. I'm not sure. But what can you tell me about your interests and how you've pulled that into the stories that you make, or the themes that you make for your art pieces?
Well, yeah, mythology is pretty huge. And, you know, I think it's funny because I can actually trace my interest in mythology to somewhere back to about the third or fourth grade. And I remember I had a set of, and I don't know if you remember these, they were like the golden book encyclopedias. They were like a kid's encyclopedia book, and they were yellow.
Oh, yeah.
And they were like almost every little kid had one. And they were just, you know, a very, very, you know, very pictorially biased. And I remember just, you know, sort of, you know, bored, you know, maybe Legos on the ground, you know, whatever.
Right. Yep.
And I came across an entry that was Days of the Week.
Okay.
And suddenly it broke down, you know, it had all these things like Thursday, you know, and then it said Thursday, you know, and Friday was Frigg's Day. And, you know, so it broke down all the different gods. And I'm like, well, who are these guys? And then, of course, on the bottom, it says, see Norse gods. And so you go, okay, they're there. And all of a sudden there's that. And then it says, see Greek gods. And I'm like, whoa, there's this, you know, all these really cool people who have all these really cool powers. And so I can literally trace, you know, that my interest to mythology then. And then, of course, exponentially, it just grew to the point of just, you know, pretty much any religion or any belief system, you know, became intriguing to me.
Okay.
And so even to this day, even on a contemporary level, I mean, just looking at the sort of the gods of our day, you know, the comic books, you know, the especially now that the comic hero in the movies, they're really not dissimilar than Thor was. Thor now is not that dissimilar than Thor was, or, you know, is Captain America any different than, you know, Odysseus in some ways, right?
Right.
So, and of course my interest in Joseph Campbell and the concepts of comparative religions, of like all the different stories and mythologies, and how, oh, that story is really pretty consistent with this story that's on two places that have never met. And so these types of things were really intriguing to me, how, you know, every culture has these stories, and they're different in some ways, vastly similar in other ways. And the thing I how that relates to my art is that I see, you know, I guess when I'm taking found objects in particular, that's sort of a creation myth, really. You know, you take something that has a past life, has an existence, and then you basically give it a new birth. You say, I will take these things, and suddenly there's a new story that comes out of that. And usually the way I work, seldom do I start off with like a concept, you know, like if I will say, oh, I'm going to do something on this. So maybe that's the case, but normally, a lot of the concepts will come out of the things that I'm working on. So I'll put some things together, and then suddenly the story or my interest, and it might be a mythology I create myself, or it might be something and say, you know, this has sort of a Medusa-esque story. And then that I start leaning the piece once that becomes visible.
Okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So the object is coming first and the story's coming second.
Usually. Okay. Sometimes, you know, that's not always the case. You know, sometimes you have a commission or something and say, oh, I want, you know, this particular thing and work that way. But I tend to prefer to let something grow and sort of see what manifests, because I think it's fresher.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so pushed that way.
Okay. So, well, where do you get your pieces to begin with? Because we're talking about 3D objects. You say you're painting them as well, but you're painting and you're adding things, and you're adding texture, and you're adding combining so many different objects. So the base, I mean, some things probably don't even, they probably have multiple bases, but the base could be it could be a box, it could be a metal canister. Can you kind of describe, maybe think of one piece and you can describe that so the people listening to this podcast can understand what we're talking about for the art that you make?
For instance, there's probably a really good example for that would be, there's a piece I did a number of years ago that was based on Lilith. And Lilith was a Judaic myth of, you know, Adam's first wife. So as the story goes, is that, you know, before Eve, there was Lilith. She, you know, it's a long story, but she basically shuns Adam. She splits. She's like, I'm out of here. You're not my guy. And she was actually made of the same stuff as Adam, right? So she leaves, she becomes a demon, and so now historically she's represented as sort of this demon. Oh, be careful of Lilith. And, you know, and so they often, if you see like the hand with the eye in the center of it, you know, that's to ward off Lilith, you know, because Lilith kind of trying to get even. And so that all started from I had this piece, and it has sort of a demonic sort of woman, and then it has these little creepy little offspring in these little slots. And it's kind of an eerie piece, but that was because it was a demon, right? So, but this big piece started from something I found in North Carolina, and it was a box, a long box, probably about 4 feet long, and it had all these little slots in it. And I couldn't figure out for the life of me what these little slots were. And then I found out it was used as a dynamite mold.
Oh,
so right. So basically it was a box, and you'd sort of put your dynamite stuff in there, and then you'd close it. So that's what these little slots are. And then you'd open up and it would form dynamite. So that's, you know, what these little slots are. And then you can see inside and all that stuff. And so I started with this box, and I had no idea. This was long before I thought of the Lilith thing, But I had this thing, and then I started adding things to it. So I actually turned this box into sort of a creature that had, because one of the things about Lilith was that she was she had all these demonic offspring, and so inside little compartments were little creepy offspring of hers. So, but that, I mean, that's a prime example of like, I have this box, what am I going to do with it? And then just taking it bizarrely tangential way. I had no idea I was going to go full on Lilith with it, but that's just what happened. And, you know, even as I started adding things, when I added sort of in the center of it, I had sort of a head. And I think, you'll be able to find an image of it pretty easily. Because I'll send some images your way, but I think you'll be able to find it pretty easily. But it all started from a box. And so normally it's a thing that I come across and then it just evolves. And a lot of times I'll find something in a store and I'll say, oh, wow, you know, this is really cool. You know, I have no idea what I'm going to do with it. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, that has to go into this piece, because metaphorically, maybe I'm working on a Pegasus piece, for instance. Well, metaphorically, I happen to need three little characters to represent the three weird sisters that sort of, you know, anyway, the whole story, right? And so you just never know when something's going to relate, which is the advantage of having a lot of crap in your studio.
Right.
So if you have a lot of crap in your studio, you have a lot, you know, you can rummage through stuff, so.
Yeah, yeah, you've got to have a little bit of an inventory to spark your imagination. Yeah. Yeah. And so are you searching for things everywhere you go?
Yeah, I've gotten to a little bit of a point where I'm kind of a critical mass. So
okay.
I'm doing a little more searching specifically. So I'll work with what I have, and then if I get to a roadblock, I'll say, "Okay, I need to go looking for stuff." And one of the downsides, you know, Vancouver is a really beautiful, you know, beautiful city.
Right.
The problem is junking is really tough up here, because we don't have the, you know, it's not like being in North Carolina where you have, you know, centuries of history, you know, and people are just throwing stuff out. It's like, oh yeah, this is from 18, whatever, who cares, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
Not that long here. So it's, you know, it's more expensive to go junking here than down in certainly the South, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
a little bit from Europe, right? So.
Yeah, I discovered that. My sister is big on antiquing and looking for different things, and she lives in Virginia. And I went with her in North Carolina and also in Virginia. And I live in Florida, and Florida doesn't have the history like the other states in the South. I always say, I don't live in the South. You have to drive north to hit the South when you're in Florida.
Right, right.
But she also saw a distinction between Virginia, which had the wealthier farmers, and versus North Carolina, which were a lot more poor people. And so you would see more of the utilitarian things in North Carolina, the useful things.
Yeah.
And then in Virginia, you would see more toys. Because people had the kids, they had more time on their hands. You know, the kids weren't out working in the fields. And I thought that was an interesting distinction that she made from those two different states.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I hadn't really thought about it, but that totally makes sense. I know the other thing that I noticed, like in North Carolina, was that you'd have a lot of because it's, you know, it has a long religious history.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of churches that are, you know, falling to pieces, and so you have a lot of innards from churches.
Oh, shrines, right.
Altars, stuff like that, tons and tons of that. And I remember seeing this big altar, and I was like, oh, I wonder how much it would cost to U-Haul that from North Carolina.
Yeah, could you get any farther away? Let's take this to Vancouver.
Exactly.
Or even Missoula. Gosh.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, that's crazy. Yep. So yeah, do you find yourself planning to bring an empty suitcase whenever you go to Mexico or New Orleans so you can find things?
New Orleans for sure, because New Orleans, though, you know, it's like everything. It's sort of getting a little bit harder and harder every year, because, you know, as interest grows in antiques, you know, it becomes a little more difficult. But the interesting thing about Mexico is everybody thinks they're going to find all these treasures, these antiques, But it's sort of like what I was referring to earlier, and that is that, you know, everything is used to the nth degree. So people don't get rid of stuff, you know, that readily. So when people go down there, it's like, oh, I'm going to get all these great antiques. Like, well, you're not.
Yeah,
you
know, the antiques are still in.
You pay antique prices for it.
Right, right. Yeah, they're still using them.
Yeah.
How did you get the interest in Day of the Dead to begin with?
Oh, well.
Like for me, I had never heard of it. So how did it get into your radar, so to speak?
Well, you know, it's funny because I can't exactly remember when it became apparent to me. I know it was probably sometime in the 80s, you know, it registered what it was. But really it was the first trip I took to Mexico. It wasn't during Day of the Dead, but I went to Oaxaca, which is where I typically go. And that's really Day of the Dead Central. I mean, if you're going to go Day of the Dead, and a lot of, if you saw the movie Coco, a lot of that movie was designed about stuff that you would see in Oaxaca.
Okay.
And I went down there, and there was a lot, it was around Christmas time, actually, the first time I went down there, right before Christmas. And there was still a lot of the Day of the Dead stuff. And so I remember seeing a lot of, you know, calacas, which are the little scenes, you know, where it had like funny little skeletons, you know, oh, a skeleton in a dentist's office or
right.
whatever.
Right. Yeah.
And I remember seeing a bunch of those and going, wow, these are really cool. These are really interesting.
Yeah.
And then it sort of, I did, you know, start doing research and realized how big a deal this really was. You know, it wasn't just like, oh, people just, you know, putting some candles on a grave. I mean, it was a big deal. It was a major, major event, bigger, and in fact, bigger than Christmas. As
oh, okay.
Event.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And at least in Oaxaca, it is. Now, as I said, it varies area to area, but it's, you know, it's a big, big event. And then I, you know, with my sort of darker sensibilities, you know, my interest in sort of, you know, sort of shadier things, you know, the whole idea of having a whole holiday filled with skeletons.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Really keeps, you know, so a couple of years later, I went down, you know, to actually experience it. And it was just, I remember the first cemetery I walked into, and it was in this village called Hohokotlan outside of Oaxaca. And it was just, I mean, you know, it's music playing. There's a big carnival in front of the cemetery. And you walk into the cemetery, and it's just a sea of candles and marigolds and families and Day of the Dead toys. And it was, to this day, I would say it's the most most beautiful thing I've ever experienced. It was just like this magical moment. I just remember the very first time and just like going, wow. And I had my camera. And I didn't know if I wanted to take pictures or just absorb the moment, because sometimes you can get lost behind the lens, right?
Right.
I was just like, wow, this is like so cool. And it's not dark or sinister. I mean, in a way it is, I guess, but it really is such a, it is really such a beautiful, stunning event. And so then, of course, I got sort of latched onto it, and then started running my retreats down in Oaxaca, you know, probably about 10 years later, maybe a little less.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you do it just during the time of Day of the Dead, or do you do retreats throughout the year?
No, just Day of the Dead.
Okay.
Mostly because I know that I am looking at other events like in Latin America. Like I'm looking at an event in Antigua, probably in 2020 in Antigua, Guatemala, that would be during Easter week, where they do big tapestries of flowers all over the all, you know, just these floral, like floral sand paintings all over the city, basically.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But Day of the Dead is such a big event for me, and it's just such an important thing. One of the coolest things about that event is it's hard to go to that event. Now, obviously, we're doing a workshop, and I try and tie the workshop into the place in some way. So whatever we're doing relates to either Day of the Dead or the region we're in. But the thing that I would say is that there have been several instances over the years where people come to the workshop partially for me, but partially because they want to see the place. But a third part is often they have something they need to resolve in terms of issues of death and dying, because there's no more magical place to try and resolve those issues. We have there's a cemetery we go to every year where one of the students a number of years ago brought her mother's ashes with her.
Oh,
and
boy.
Went to the cemetery and there was a tree. And so she decided, okay, there's nothing there. It wouldn't be disturbing somebody's grave or anything like that. So she put her ashes, by the tree, and she lit a little candle, and then mariachi band came over and serenaded her as, she sort of celebrated her mother. So that tree, we go to the cemetery every year. That tree has sort of become like our group's little place. Like if they, want to remember someone, they can put a candle on that tree and so it's kind of a nice way to be in a foreign land where they're celebrating something, but also feel like you're part of it.
Right.
At the same time, you're not encroaching, you're celebrating with them. You're using their event to help, to help celebrate your lost one,
okay.
Lost loved one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a cool thing that's happened over the years.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So when people are coming there to take a workshop with you, your workshops are 3D objects like the art that you make. Are they having to bring a bunch of stuff so that they can make this art?
Originally when I started doing it, I used to think, we'll just find stuff there. And there is stuff we can find there. There's, we go to religious stores where we get, lots of if you need a resplendor, which are those sort of fiery things behind the saints and stuff, right? So you can find that stuff. New stuff, the antique stuff harder, or toys are easy to find. And since we do a lot of antiquing with new stuff, so we make stuff, new stuff look old, it's, you don't have to necessarily bring stuff. It's probably helpful to, I do have people bring at least some stuff.
Okay.
Just because, it's just sort of, if you have something you want to work with, maybe you'll find it, maybe you won't. So it is funny looking at some people, a few people this year posted some photographs of their suitcases as they were packing, and it's just like,
how do you explain this?
Right, how do you explain that, and it's like, nobody seems to have a problem with, all the creepy doll heads, stacked in there with, it just seems to get on through. So,
yeah. So what are some of the other places that you've taught? Because I know you've taught all over the world.
Yeah. Let's see. This year, my wife, Andrea, and I, we did a duo class on the island of Sifnos in Greece. So we did a little class, a little Greek island, which was really fun. Italy is a place that I've gone to, in Tuscany, that I've done some workshops there. Portugal, we did some in Lisbon, and that was really a fun trip. Bali, which was great. Yeah, Bali was cool because, of course, my interest in mythology, and Bali has, their version of Hinduism.
Okay.
The ancient Balinese god mixed with the Balinese Hindu gods, and that was always really a treat, just to see all the really cool, interesting little deities floating around there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's, it's been kind of all over. I mean, I it's funny because I classify my New Orleans retreat as kind of a foreign country, because New Orleans is probably like the most foreign country that you can go to in the States without leaving the United States.
Yep.
It's just has,
I think you're right.
So I sort of classify that into my foreign land excursions. So, but there's a lot that, there's a lot that I'm looking into. Like, I know that one of these days, one of my goals is to try and figure out a Krampus, Krampus, which is the Christmas devil. So Krampus was like in Victorian times and earlier, you'd often see like little Victorian cards and, Slavic nations, or not Slavic, but like Norwegian and Scandinavian. Mm-hmm. Areas, and you'd have like you'd see Saint Nick, and then you'd see like this devil guy who would and he'd be he's like, you kids be good, or the Krampus is going to get you, type of thing, right? And so like in Salzburg, they have a big Krampus parade every year, and of all these devils out scaring.
Oh wow, that'd be amazing. Go to Austria that time.
Yeah, so of course the challenge is trying to get people to to go to a workshop in early December because it's always a tough time of year. But that's a goal. And we're actually, my wife, Andrea, and I are looking at India, if we can try and figure that out. That's one of the places that we're toying around with. So there's always an interesting place to go. And I think for me, one of the things that I love, well, first off, I love travel, but one of the things I found really useful as an instructor is going to a place, letting the place influence what the students are doing, because the work becomes that much richer. You know, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you go to a place and it's like, wow, you have all this inspiration. And I mean, there's stuff there, but there's also just the place that can really, you know, motivate what it is that you create. And that to me is, you know, like the best.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I love to travel too. About how much of your year are you traveling to teach classes?
Well, you know, these days it's not as much. I mean, back in the olden days, it was, you know, quite a bit. I would say I was gone almost, you know, pretty close to half the year solid. I'd say these days it's probably about, I think I'm gone about 3 months out of the year if you were to mush it all together.
Okay.
Well,
tell me your wife's name so we can hear it out loud. I know who your wife is, but tell me her name and what is the type of art that she does? Because I know that you collaborate. You do joint classes with her, right?
Yep, sure do. So Andrea Mattis, and she is a painter, also sort of collage. So she does a sort of combination of painting collage, and also a bit of assemblage. So she does, you know, well, I wouldn't say she does a little of that. She does do a fair amount of that as well. So what we typically do when we do duo classes, like what we did in Greece, for instance, we also did one in Italy. Italy would be a good example. Like we were doing a sort of a Renaissance themed workshop in Cortona. And so what I would do was sort of the three-dimensional Renaissance sort of frame with little creatures and gargoyle-y sort of things. Then she would do the panel. She was actually teaching sort of a painting collage slash also gold leafing of the thing side of it. So a lot of times it's sort of like, you know, sort of a my part, her part type of thing. So seldom do we sort of intertwine as, you know, it's like, oh, I'll do this on top of hers. That I always find that really tough to do. So it's like, okay, you do this part, I'll do that part, and then, you know,
right,
sort of move together.
Yeah,
so,
let's not step on each other while we're doing this.
Right. Because I hey, what did you do? That was my favorite part. You just covered over that. You
know? Right. So, yeah, but how great to now be doing things with your wife and traveling all over. That's wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a lot of fun. It's a nice way to be able to blend styles. One thing we started doing in New Orleans too, I have the main part of the workshops, and what we did though is we decided to do like an optional, like with Andrea, she has a little one-day pre-class. So if people want to do a little mini class related to the theme, she does that. So it's kind of a fun way to kind of make sure we're both incorporated in wherever we go. So
there you go. All right. Yeah. I want to talk about one more type of, or I don't know what to call it, some art that you've done recently, because I saw it on Instagram and you did it with, what did you call it? Holy rollers.
Oh yeah.
Was that Hot Wheels or Matchbox cars?
Both, yeah. Though the Hot Wheels are better to race with.
So. Yeah, okay. So you're making this, and if you can send me one of those photos, I'll put that on my website. Yeah. I just think they're great. But my question for you is, did this come from a car-shaped carrying box full of Matchbox or Hot Wheels that you had growing up and that you've had your whole life? Because just about every boy they've had, and girls too, we had a box of those in our toy closet at my parents' house. And it was still there at age 50. It was still in my parents' closet. Were these ones that you had forever?
No, I mean, they weren't. I do remember though. I mean, yeah. I vividly remember my, you know, the collection. I remember even having my favorite Hot Wheels. It was always when races. It was a Porsche, and it was chrome. It was chrome colored, right?
Oh, so, yeah, I had one of those. Yeah,
it would always win. It would always win any race. You know, it was
on
so
the
cool.
orange tracks.
Yeah, and I remember the superchargers, which were the little houses that would shoot them out and make them more. Yeah.
Yeah,
but those were great. I don't even know what happened to all my original Hot Wheels.
Okay.
Stuff would be like, you know, maybe everybody's like, oh, he doesn't use this anymore. And,
right. Yeah.
But the one advantage of, you know, being sort of a scrounger is that, you know, there's always, half the time I don't know where I get stuff. It's sort of like, could have been, you know, Hot Wheels I had in my collection when I first started doing them could have been from a box that somebody gave me, as far as I know, you know, right. Sort of like, where did that come from? I don't know. It's, you know, something. But yeah, but one thing I will say is that, yeah, you definitely, if you're going to race them, like, because that was the whole idea of this, of these holy rollers, was they can hang on the wall, but they also have to be able to race.
Right. So you weren't adding things to the back side of it. The wheels could still move. Yeah.
Right. Make sure those wheels go. So thus it was important to make sure I was using Hot Wheels versus Matchbox, because Matchboxes, as you may or may not know, really suck for racing.
Right.
They just don't. They don't have the wheels. So.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yes. No, I understand. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. But hey, if you can make something out of a Pez dispenser, of course you can make something out of Hot Wheels too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I just want to talk about, gosh, we could talk forever, but I just want to talk about one more thing. You do offer some online classes too, or video classes. Can you tell me about some of those?
Yeah, so I've got actually quite a few. I was just kind of looking through them the other day, in fact. And speaking of the Hot Wheels, that's the one I'm running right now. And pretty much all my classes are pretty much, you know, you can do them while they're running, but they're also available on demand also. So after runs, all that stuff's available. So I have a number of classes that are sort of topical, like color washes or texture or constructing. And then the vast majority of them are by and large sort of thematic. So, you know, like the Holy Rollers, Hot Wheels class, you know, that one, obviously. The, I did one called Altered Alice, where we did a stage theater with all the little, you know, found object Alice characters. And we built a little puppet theater, essentially, with Alice in Wonderland themed stuff. So, you know, so there's a whole bunch of different sort of topics and things like that. And as I said, it's the type of thing, like, you buy it, you pretty much own it forever. You can download it or not. It's up to you. But it's, you know, it's one buy one time and keep forever type stuff. So it's pretty. Yeah.
So what is the amount of time it should take to complete one of these courses, or are they all different?
Well, roughly, I'd say all said and done, it's probably about 6 hours of video, more or less, if you give or take. I think some a little less than others, but if you add in Q&As, like while the class is running live, for instance, I do a weekly Q&A. All of those Q&As are available after the class is done, so to say. So even if you bought it later, most of the questions are answered. You know, if you have any questions, most likely some student will have answered that, you know, or asked that in the course of the event. So,
right.
Yeah. So I'd say it's roughly 6 hours all said and done. So, and I try and make them pretty fun. I try not to be dry. Well, that's true in teaching in general. I try not to be like, well, and then we must take this. And that, you know, I try and avoid that as much as possible.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've taken one class from you live, and I thought it was really fun and interesting, and I would do it again, but I just haven't been able to travel.
Which class did you take?
You know, I don't remember what it was called, but we started with a wooden box with a lid. And so you had one for everybody. And so we all got the wooden box, and I think I took off my lid, and I'll show you when we're done. I'll show it in the screen. Yeah.
I wonder if it was the Morpheus box. Did the inside spin?
No, they didn't spin, but I'll tell you why I took your class. I had gone to Portland Art and Soul, and it's for people who don't know, and that's still a retreat that still exists today. It's in a hotel, and they have multiple banquet rooms. And so I'm in one banquet room taking a class, and you were in the next banquet room teaching a class. And at the end of the day, and like we said, it was just a one-day class. At the end of the day, you took your students outside of the classroom into the kind of hallway lobby area, and it was kind of a show and tell, and everybody was showing what they did, and you were talking about. And I thought that was so interesting, the give and take, how you were giving every single person 5 minutes of your time and saying, look what Susie did. And she decided to put this here. Isn't that interesting? And I just thought that was so encouraging to your students. That's why I took your class the next year, because I really liked that.
It's interesting you bring that up, because that's actually a really important part of my classes is, because I, at the end of every single class, I play the theme song to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Okay.
Like, ooh, right. And then, you know, it means time's up, pencils down. And then I go through everybody's piece. And, you know, granted, that can take an hour, you know,
right,
in some cases. But it's such a, it really is important. And obviously it's not a critique in the sense of, like, I know some people get a little nervous because they think back to art school.
Right.
And they're like, oh, I'm never going to do art again. And that's not really the goal. It's mostly just to try and show the student, as well as the other people in the class, of things that they can learn from this piece, you know, and try and, you know, be encouraging about, look what you did, and see, let other people see how they accomplished this. And it is really, really important to feel like at the end of the day that you did something of value. Even though you might not necessarily see it right off the bat, I think it's important as an instructor that I say, hey, look, no, you did this. This is important. And, you know, go through everybody and make sure that, you know, everybody sees that sort of stuff. So,
right.
Yeah. It's important. So,
yeah. Yeah. Because just going to these classes is a big jump out of people's comfort levels, just to go and try something new. And for me, I had never done anything 3D like that. And I traveled across the country to do it. So, it's a big deal for a lot of people.
The other thing I think too about the critiques is that it also gives a sense of theater to it, because one of the things that I felt when I first started teaching, I didn't start doing that, but one of the things that I noticed is that the first year I taught, it was like class was just over.
Right.
You know, it's like the bell rings, everybody gets up, and it was anticlimactic. There was no sense of closure. And so what I felt was, by doing that, you get a sense of completion.
Yep.
You know, this, look at what, and we're done, and, you know, close the chapter. And it really made a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that. So I'm looking at your website. You've listed one class for a workshop. I forget which one it is. Maybe it's New Orleans.
Yeah.
But do you have a full calendar for 2019 that you'll announce?
Yeah. So that'll be coming up probably in the next, I know when this will actually, probably by the time this airs, I'll at least have, you know, sort of a, if I don't have specific dates or websites, a lot of TBAs will be up, but I have it pretty well fleshed in about what's coming up next year. So some of which you can go and check out directly. Otherwise the just waiting for the links to go live. So,
okay. What is the name of your website?
MichaelDemeng.com.
Okay. And what are the social media that you are active on?
Facebook, Instagram, those, you know, kind of the two main ones that I use. YouTube a little bit, but mostly Facebook and Instagram.
Okay. Okay. Well, I know I saw a video you did on YouTube, and this was years ago, but let me know if this is still up on YouTube somewhere. You did a video in Mexico of the Island of Dolls. I don't know if that's the right name. Oh my gosh, that's the creepiest, best video I've ever seen.
I went out there to the Island of Dolls. It's little island in the middle of, in sort of a rural part of Mexico City, of just filled with, I think they estimate somewhere around about 5-10,000 old dolls hanging all over the island.
Oh my
something
gosh.
Like that.
Wow. Yeah. Well, does that still exist on YouTube?
You can definitely track it down.
I'll find the link.
Island. Yep.
Okay, sure. I'll put some links up on my show notes. Yeah. Well, this has been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, you're welcome. What a great interview. Perhaps you'll be inspired to do something with your old Hot Wheels cars or Pez dispensers. Be sure and check out my show notes on my website so you can see photos of Michael's art. You can tell just by looking at each piece that there's a story behind every one. The story may be about the objects he used to make the art, or the location where he found them, or it may be about the final art piece. Hopefully you'll start to think about the stories that your artwork can tell. Here are a few takeaways from this episode. Number 1. The 3D artwork that Michael makes is called assemblage, or assemblage, as he says it. He uses discarded objects and puts them to new uses, giving them new meaning and a unique story. Number two, there are benefits to teaching one-day classes and to teaching multi-day classes. In one day, a student can get close to finishing a whole project, and for a few days, they can take their time and not be so rushed when learning new techniques. Number three, taking destination art classes are a great way to get away from your busy life and just concentrate on art making for a few days. Number four, if you're hosting a destination art class, let the location motivate what you create. For example, when Michael teaches in New Orleans, the classes take on a theme that is appropriate to that area. Number five, try to incorporate your interests into your artwork, like Michael has done with his interest in mythology and comparative religions. Number six, Michael makes his art by choosing the object first and making the story second. He has taken things that have a past and given them a new birth. Number seven, when partnering with another instructor to teach a class, keep the portions that you're teaching separate from the other teachers. You don't want to have the students paint over something that the other instructor has just taught. And number eight, at the end of Michael's classes, he reviews each person's piece so that others can learn from what everyone has done. He does this to encourage students and let them know that they have done something of value. I hope you've enjoyed hearing Michael talk about the art that he makes and the classes he teaches. If this kind of artwork interests you, check out his workshop schedule for the coming year and consider taking one of his destination art classes. I had no experience in assemblage when I took his class, but I was able to learn his techniques of design and composition and adhering disparate pieces together. I've included a photo of the piece that I did in his class in the show notes on my website, along with lots of photos of his artwork. You can also go to his website at michaeldemang.com to see more of his art, or you can visit his Instagram page. My Facebook page for this podcast is called The Left Brain Artist. You can also find me on Instagram at The Left Brain Artist. I post photos of my own artwork on my personal Instagram account, which is called Suzanne Redman Art. Feel free to follow both of these accounts. If you're enjoying these podcast episodes, please go on iTunes and leave me a review. And thank you for listening to the Left Brain Artist podcast. I'm Suzanne Redmond. See you next time.